I mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people, you know, realize what's really going on in this country. There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for: freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now. You know, what's going on in this country in the past, what's going on currently, these aren't new situations. This isn't new ground. It's things that have gone on in this country for years and years and have never been addressed, and they need to be. Yes, I'll continue to sit. I'm going to continue to stand with the people that are being oppressed. To me, this is something that has to change. And when there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am a Seattle Seahawks fan. I do watch a little bit of the football, and I watch a lot more of the soccer. So usually I'm in the position where I'm rooting against Kaepernick. See, if you don't pay attention to sports, the 49ers have a bit of a rivalry with the Seahawks. I mean, we're two West Coast teams, and when we go up against each other, to say that it's contentious is really to say the least. So I find myself in this interesting position in the last month or so where I am rooting for Kaepernick. More on that in a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 176. My name is Mel, and I want to thank you so much for being here. As we're going to do on today's show, as we do every week, we're going to knock down some right-wing myths. The idea that you have to fill people's heads with crap in order to get them to vote for you is one that I would like to believe does not exist, but it very much does. We're going to get into it a little bit later about how most of what you've seen with respect to conditions in society, a lot of the opinions that people hold, completely born out of talk radio. And whether you listen to talk radio or not, it's running your life. Because a lot of these dum-dums that believe these things that aren't true, they get them by and large from one source and one source only, and that is talk radio. But I do want to start this hour by saying, yes, it's a real thing. Black people are being murdered. And for whatever reason, white people have decided to turn a blind eye again to this.
There's a lot of things that need to change. One specifically is police brutality. There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people. That's not right. That's not right by anyone's standards.
He's taking a lot of heat, Kaepernick is, for not standing during the national anthem. The national anthem in America, is the Star Spangled Banner. And it was written by Francis Scott Key. And it didn't immediately become our national anthem after it was written. It really just sat aside in the dustbin of history for a little while. And then somewhere during the 20th century, early in the 20th century, about 117 years after it was written, we decided to make it our national anthem. But before it could become our national anthem, some things had to be stripped out of it. The first and foremost is the meaning of the hireling in the slave. There is a third verse that we've stripped out of it that a lot of people don't know about. And Colin Kaepernick, for those of you that don't know or listen around the world, Colin Kaepernick is black. In recent years, he has begun looking, to the chagrin of a lot of America, more black. He's been growing his hair out. He's been wearing an afro. And that was already kind of a source of you know, among the white people that pay attention. And now, a black man has decided not to stand up during the national anthem, which has a third verse written by Francis Scott Key, who is a stark, raging racist, who loved the slavery of their time period. This from The Intercept. It took 117 years from the time the Star Spangled Banner was written in 1814 until it was legally enshrined as the national anthem in 1931. Francis Scott Key wrote the poem that became the song's lyrics on September 14th, 1814, after witnessing the British bombardment of Fort McHenry in Baltimore during the War of 1812. As The Intercept has recently noted, Key's little-known third stanza includes these lines. No refugee could save the hireling and the slave from the terror of flight and the gloom of the grave, and the star-spangled banner in triumph doth wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. By the time Key wrote these words, the British military included a regiment of former slaves called the Colonial Marines, whom the British had encouraged to escape and then trained and armed. In fact, just weeks before, on August 24th, 1814, the Colonial Marines had participated in the Battle of Bladensburg outside of Washington, D.C. The Bladensburg fight was a quick, embarrassing defeat for American troops, something Key knew because he had witnessed it up close as a volunteer aide to the U.S. general. The British forces, including the Colonial Marines, had then continued to Washington the same day, infamously occupying and torching the White House. I don't think a lot of people know, the White House has actually been burned down before. The Intercept stated that slave referred to these Colonial Marines. However, an enormous number of readers argued that this identification was incorrect and that Key did not literally mean escaped slaves. Key himself has never explained precisely what he meant by the third stanza. According to Mark Leibson, author of the recent biography Key, Key spoke about the Star Spangled Banner in public just once and did not mention this issue. Key did not write about the song in his surviving letters. That said, Leibson explains, while researching for his book, he did not find any historians who interpreted the hiring and the slave as anything but a reference to the enslaved people who escaped their bonds and went to the British side. Among the academic experts with this perspective is Alan Taylor, a University of Virginia professor and one of the foremost contemporary scholars of early U.S. history. Two of Taylor's books have won a Pulitzer Prize. One of these, The Internal Enemy, addresses the song's third stanza, calling it Key's dig at the British for employing Colonial Marines. By the mid-1800s, the phrase hireling and slave could be found in the writing of slavery's supporters to differentiate between wage laborers and those in actual bondage. Whether this usage was adopted from the Star Spangled Banner or the other way around is unclear, but William Grayson, a U.S. representative from South Carolina, even titled an 1855 pro-slavery poem as, you guessed it, The Hireling and the Slave. Grayson contended that slavery had been a blessing for Africans and was morally superior to a system of wage work. Grayson also described whites as being a new term that he coined, the master race. Recently on his show, Bill O'Reilly decided to not necessarily come out and support slavery, but to say, hey, they had three squares, they had a place to live, they wanted for nothing, roof over their heads, what were they, easy, it was human bondage. And even still today, there's a need to defend that human bondage, whether implicit or explicit. And what we find with police killings in America is there's more and more conservatives, and this shouldn't be a political issue, humans are humans, but there's more and more conservatives that are willing to defend the murder of black people, especially if it's done by police.
They tell you this to your face, black Hispanics between 14 to 21, they must get stopped.
At the end of the month, these officers, whoever don't have that arrest, or those few summonses, they're pressured to find something. You might not see nothing. You're supposed to be visible. You might not see anything, but you go hunting, like bounty hunting for an arrest. Locking up some old guy, some homeless guy, finding somebody who's riding a bicycle on the sidewalk, who's spitting, and you bring him in.
The problem is when you go hunting, when you put any type of numbers on a police officer to perform, we are going to go to the most vulnerable.
The most vulnerable.
Of course. We're going to go to LGBT community. We're going to go to the black community. We're going to go to those people that have no vote, that have no power. If we start doing what we're doing in Midtown Manhattan, a phone call to the mayor's office is going to be made, that's going to be the end of it.
We're the predators, they're the prey. The worst thing you can have is a police officer that needs an arrest for the month.
So you're all minorities. How does that make you feel?
It's horrible.
This is something coming from the top that trickles its way down, and this is why we're all here today.
That was a montage of police officers from WNBC, and they were all minorities. And what they were pointing out was that in New York, they were encouraged to go after minorities. If there's money to be made, if there's a quota to be met, to go after minorities. And why? Well, that's because they're the weakest. Now, remember, this is New York, but this is New York under Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani implemented stop and frisk, and you don't have to wonder who largely got stopped and frisked. It was African Americans. Police are not bad. I myself spent years studying policing. I myself wanted to be a police officer. I'm almost 40 now, and so I have moved on to other things. Life kind of got in the way of making that happen, and a lot of my friends were disappointed that I wanted to be a police officer. But even now, I still don't regret the idea of being a police officer or all the years that I spent trying to become a police officer. I did testing, both physical and mental. I did ride-alongs, and I gained a large degree of respect for police. I worked alongside troopers. I worked alongside local police officers, and I got to talk to any number of them. So I don't have a problem with police, but there is something happening right now that we can't deny, where African Americans are largely being targeted. And the way the right is telling us to approach this is they're saying, there's not a problem. Maybe if they weren't doing things wrong, they wouldn't be getting killed. You don't want to get killed? Well, then don't break the law. Well, now, wait a minute. Breaking the law is not supposed to be a death sentence.
Agreed. I have a very unique perspective, Skip.
Okay.
I'm from rural South Georgia.
You are.
I'm 48 years old, Skip. And if I don't tell you my religion, you can't guess it. If I don't tell you my mom's name, you couldn't guess it. I was dirt poor. 1,000 square feet, 10 people sometime, cement floor, tin roof. I'm well off now. The one thing that I've been for 48 years is black. That's what you see. You don't see my religion. You don't see my orientation. You don't know my political affiliation. But you see this. I see people get on shows and the officers say non-compliance. Well, I saw a guy in Florida, a white guy, stab two people, kill him. Stabbed another guy, was eating the guy's face. Female officer tased him. They have to wait 10, 15 minutes, and they take him alive. I see a guy selling CDs, and he's killed. I see a guy selling loose leaf cigarettes, and he's killed. See, that's what gets us up in arms.
I should.
Because you say noncompliance is a death sentence. If a man is gnawing a man's face after he's killed two people, we see what happened in Colorado. The guy killed 12, and they take him alive. We see what happened in Charleston. What nine parishioners. He drives. Not only do they take him alive, they take him by Burger King because he's hungry. So you think we're supposed to be okay with this?
No.
In what system?
That's Shannon Sharp, a football player, talking with another. Now, Shannon Sharp is a commentator now. And obviously, Shannon Sharp is African-American. And what he pointed out there is very stark, and it illustrates that there is a different way that people are being handled. The guy, there was a video of a gentleman walking around the streets, waving around a gun, grabbing his crotch, and the police pulled up, and they sort of stood by their doors, and they just crossed their arms, and they just watched him for a little while. They were trying to talk him out of it, and they just sort of watched him for a little while. But then there's a 12-year-old playing with a fake gun in a public park, and the police pull up, and within seconds, that child is dead. It's not even a real gun. And I understand how complicated police work is, but it's hard to say that race doesn't play a role in this.
World War II, there are a lot of African Americans that went to foreign soil to fight.
Mm-hmm.
They were fighting for freedoms in a foreign land that when they came home, they didn't enjoy themselves. Under that flag, with those veterans. So think about this. You go to Germany, and you go overseas, and you fight for freedoms of people you have no idea, have nothing in common with. In the very country that you're representing, when you come back to it, you're a second-class citizen.
Correct.
Muhammad Ali died recently, and he went on the BBC not long after he won. And this, he was from the segregated South. So, you know, not long after he was the world champion in boxing, you know, he won at the Olympics, you know, and he grew up in the segregated South. And he wasn't allowed to drink out of certain fountains. He wasn't allowed to go to certain restaurants. And he lived in all of that. And then he became the champion. And he went off and he represented America. And he came back to America. And he said, man, well, you know what? I'm going to let him tell the story.
Won the Olympic gold medal in Rome, Italy. Olympic champion. The Russian standing right here. And the Pole right here. Is Poland considered a communist country?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm defeating America's so-called threats or enemies. And the flag is going, ton, 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 ton. I'm standing so proud. Ton, 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 ton. And I done whooped the world for America. Ton, 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 ton. I took my gold medal, thought I'd invented something. I said, man, I know I'm going to get my people freedom there. I'm the champion of the whole world, Olympic champion. I know I can eat downtown now. And I went downtown that day, had my big old medal on, and went in the restaurants. At that time, black things weren't integrated. The black folks couldn't eat downtown. And I went downtown, I sat down, and I said, oh, a cup of coffee, a hot dog. He said, the lady said, we don't serve Negroes. I'm so mad. I said, I don't eat them either. Just give me a cup of hamburgers.
There was another thing that Shannon Sharp talked about, and that was the African Americans who, not just in recent history, but in history 100 years back, fought alongside European Americans, fought and died in these wars, and would still come home and were not seen as equals. Even if they fought and they wounded or they died, they wouldn't get the same kind of honors. Now, I don't know necessarily at the core what an American is. If you take the alt-right, if you take white supremacists, they will tell you that it is somebody white, preferably male, European, and Christian. That's what they will tell you an American is. But I say to you, Europeans came here, stripped this land from the Indians, put them in concentration camps and systematically murdered them and then took the land. But when we came to our senses, we began welcoming in other folks, welcoming in other races and other ethnicities and other religions. Bring me your tired. Bring me your yearning to breathe free. So it seems to me that an American is somebody who lives here, who has our values. And our values, in my opinion, is that we are a society and that we look out for each other and that we take care of one another. And yeah, sometimes it's necessary to get into conflicts. And if you don't see yourself as American where you are and what you're doing now, you definitely should after you have fought for this country or after you have been a objector and decided not to go and fight and die in this country because of the way you're treated simply because of your race.
My conscience will let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, raped and killed my mother and father. Well, I'm going to shoot them for what? How can I go shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? I'll just take me to jail.
The repercussions that he suffered from deciding not to go and fight and die in Vietnam, it was stark. But what he said, the repercussions were stark, but what he said right there, they didn't call me the N-word. Why am I going to go shoot them? There's just some poor people over there. Why am I going to go out there and kill them? They haven't done anything to me. You know who's done awful things to me? My countrymen. the people that I went to the Olympics to represent and became the world champion and came back with my head held high and proud, my countrymen did awful things to me. These people in Vietnam, they didn't do awful things to me. My countrymen did awful things to me. Quoting from the article again, Francis Scott Key could be called the most unknown famous person in U.S. history. A look at his rarely examined life makes clear how difficult it is to separate the national anthem's meaning from its author and his gross hypocrisy on the meaning of freedom. Key was born in 1779 on his wealthy family's Maryland plantation known as Terra Rubra. After childhood, he left to study law and eventually moved to Washington, D.C., where he kept one or two slaves as servants. In 1813, the year before the British attack on Fort McHenry, Key wrote to his father to inform him that he had just purchased an old woman and a little girl, about 12 or 18 years old. Key offered to send them to his parents to work on their plantation, apparently did so in a subsequent letter. He asked his mother, "How do you like the old woman and the little girl?" Now, I know what I'm going to hear. Oh, it's just the times. That's what the times were back then, right? That's just how things were. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That is a horrible phrase. There's a horrible sense. I bought a little girl and an old woman. You don't buy people. And I don't care what race they're. And I don't care what the time is. And I don't care what the zeitgeist is. You don't buy people. Should never be celebrated. In his work, Key was the prototypical Washington lobbyist. During this period, Key also represented slaveholders as a lawyer, attempting to retrieve their escaped property. In time, Key became a confidant to President Andrew Jackson. He was, in today's parlance, a Washington insider. And you may remember, Andrew Jackson was famous for the Trail of Tears, which led to the death of thousands of Indians. Key indicted John Prout, a free black school teacher who had forged papers for a young enslaved couple attempting to escape to freedom. Prout was convicted and he was forced to leave town. The next year, Key ignored the First Amendment to persecute Ben Lundy, a courageous editor who published an anti-slavery newspaper in the Capitol. Key, like many U.S. politicians after him, was a stickler for law and order. Blacks who encountered the constables serving Key often ended up robbed or dead. When a white riot swept the city in August 1835, Key sought to quell fears of a slave rebellion by seeking the death penalty for Arthur Bowen, a young black man accused of attempted murder. When doubts arose about Bowen's guilt, District Attorney Key was implacable in seeking to hang against him. To hang him. Key next prosecuted a New York doctor who had moved to Washington with a trunk of anti-slavery literature. The trial attracted attention across the nation. In the courtroom, Key emotionally denounced the abolitionists who wanted to free all enslaved people.
And so when the folks say, well, why we need the NAACP? Well, I'll lay it to you like this here. The first slave came to America in 1619. Emancipation Proclamation signed in 1863. 13th Amendment ratified in 1865. Reconstruction goes to 1877. Then there's this great compromise where Rutherford B. Hayes becomes president. They pull the troops out of the South. Jim Crow starts. So you now go through all the way through the 20th century, 1960s, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, Fair Housing Act. If you had to place a marker on when black folks have been technically fully free Americans, mm-hmm. It's 1970. That's only 46 years.
That's Roland Martin. And as he pointed out there, it really hasn't been that long that African Americans have been considered free. And even now, they're still not really considered free. But Melvin, they're on TV. They're actors. They're comedians. They're singers. Even back in the day when they were full-on slaves, they were allowed to learn a musical instrument to entertain the white people. It doesn't make them free. They used to sing in the mines. They used to sing when they were working in the fields for the white people. Does that mean that they were free? They used to get to sit and eat food. Does that mean that they're free? They got to be outside in the sunshine, the scorching southern sun. Does that mean that they were free? They were raped and they had to carry their Master's baby to term and deny that it was his. Were they free? And it really hasn't been that long since we've not had whites-only fountains. It has not been that long. And right now, in this presidential election, the dog whistle language is everywhere. And some of it's not even dog whistle. There are people openly calling for the murders, for the hangings of African Americans. A lot of the alt-right has no problem saying that they do not like white people or they do not like black people. There was a gentleman who stood outside the RNC this year holding up a sign that said, "Would you like to talk to a racist? Ask me anything." They're proud of this. And now that we have the Republican candidate, Donald Trump, they have been more emboldened than ever. So did all these racists, these horrible, horrible racists, pop up this year? No, they've been around for some time. And by the way, the killings of African Americans, unarmed African Americans by police, that's not a new thing either. You're just seeing it more because of disruptive technology. Cell phones with cameras have become so ubiquitous, you're now seeing the things that used to happen and just be kept under wraps. But now it can happen and be shown on the internet in real time. You can go Facebook Live or any of those or YouTube Live and show people, show African Americans, unarmed African Americans as they're being murdered. And that's happening right now. Jan Mikkelsen is a right-wing talk show host. And back during the 2012 election, and Republicans wonder why they lost that election, he got a call. And they asked, "What would you do about the illegals? Nativism is always the flavor when it comes to conservative politics." So somebody called and said, "What would you do about all of these illegals?"
Here's what would work. And I was asked by an immigration open borders activist a couple of weeks ago how I would get all of the illegals here in the state of Iowa to leave. So you're going to call the police every time you find an illegal? Are you going to round them up and put them in detention centers? I said, "No, you don't have to do any of that stuff." "Well, you're going to invite them to leave the country and leave Iowa?" I said, "Well, sort of." "Well, how are you going to do it, Mikkelsen? You think you're so smart? How would you get thousands of illegals to leave Iowa?" "Well," I said, "well, if I wanted to do that, I'd just put up some signs." "Well, what would the sign say?" I said, "Well, I'd put them on the end of the highway on western part of the interstate system, and I'd put them on the eastern side of the state, right there in the interstate system, and then the north on the Minnesota border, and on the south, Kansas and Missouri border. And I would just say this: as of this date, whatever we decide to do this, as of this date, 30, maybe this is a totally arbitrary number, 30 to 60 days from now, anyone who is in the state of Iowa that is not here legally and cannot demonstrate their legal status to the satisfaction of the local and state authorities here in the state of Iowa become property of the state of Iowa. So if you are here without our permission, and we've given you 2 months to leave, and you're still here, and we find that you're still here after we've given you the deadline to leave, then you become the property of the state of Iowa. And we have a job for you." And we start using compelled labor. The people who are here illegally would therefore be owned by the state and become an asset of the state rather than a liability. And we start inventing jobs for them to do.
Sounds like a clever idea. And maybe you could make it, put it in action. But I think the fallout would be so significant. You know, I think
what would be the nature of the fallout?
Well, I think everybody would believe it sounds like slavery.
Well, what's wrong with slavery?
What's wrong with slavery? What you heard was not a doctored clip. That's what he really said. What's wrong with slavery?
Well, what's wrong with slavery?
What's wrong with this is 2012 when he said this on the radio. This is pretty recent history. And then this year they decide to run the most racist candidate that they have ever run before. There is a talk show host here in Portland, which is where I broadcast out of. I don't think it's a secret anymore. And his name is Lars Larson. And I first heard the name Lars Larson about 10 years ago when Ed Schultz, who had a radio show at that time, decided to just go off on this guy. And I thought it was a funny Lars Larson. I just thought it was a funny name. It's like John Johnson, Mike Michelson. You know, it just sounded weird. But after moving here, because, I don't know, sometimes I hate myself, I listened to his show, and I spent quite a bit of time listening to his show. I never called in, and I'm fairly certain that if I ever met him, he would hate my guts and want to punch me in the face. So I'll keep you updated if that ever happens. So I was listening to his show, and he does this with some degree of frequency. Whenever one of these African Americans, unarmed, by the way, is killed by police, he'll go on his show and defend it to no end. And he's got an entire diatribe that he does. And he's shameless about it. Black people will call up his show and he will go over this same diatribe. And what it is he has spin for every single recent murder of a black man, an unarmed black man by police. He's got a justification for every single one of them. And he'll go through, he'll name the black man that was unarmed black man that was murdered by the police and tell you why it's okay that it happened. Tell you why it's justified. And he'll just go boom, 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 right down the line and just start naming them all off. Why it's okay. Why it's okay. Why the police who are murdering unarmed black people are right 100% of the time. And it's the most amazing thing I've ever heard. And this guy is a darling around here. So, yeah, I play a clip from 2012, but this is happening right now. I didn't pull any of his clips. It's only a 1 hour show. And the guy is so jubilant about black people being murdered. I'd have to give you a whole hour. And of course, Fox News staunchly defends these murders as well. D.L. Hewley went on to Megyn Kelly's show recently, and it got a bit out of hand.
Yeah, hey, we're talking about Michael Brown,
Megan,
and the lie.
Let's be clear.
Of hands up, don't shoot.
I don't dodge at all. I'm here in Fox
then
News.
Then let's stay where, on it. Then let's stay on okay, Michael Brown.
No,
Eric,
we're talking
Holder's
about
DOJ.
No. We're
so
talking about.
To get out of bounds
I'm not talking. No,
are.
Woman.
Then
I'm not trying to get out of bounds.
You don't dodge. Then let's stay in bounds.
No, we were talking about the young man that just got murdered in Minnesota. And
the
went
rush to judgment
went,
and the assumption
First off, what I'll tell you is this. It is not uncommon for you all to see one thing. The only place racism doesn't exist is Fox News and the police department.
Insulting. Just insulted millions of people watching this channel.
And you know what? I'm insulted by the things I hear on this network, so we're even. I could care less about insulting people that insult me on a daily basis.
Quoting from the article here, the popularity of the Star Spangled Banner grew continuously in the decades after Key wrote the lyrics. By the time the Civil War, some on both sides tried to claim the Star Spangled Banner as their own. By the 1920s, the battle lines were clear. Those who wanted to celebrate the post-Civil War unity of the North and South without reference to the abolition of slavery favored the Star Spangled Banner. Many Northerners preferred the emancipationist spirit of Battle Hymn of the Republic or the stately grandeur of American the Beautiful. African Americans had their own ideas and in 1926 Lift Every Voice by Florida poet James Weldon Johnson as a black national anthem. In 1931, there was finally a clear winner. Congress approved and President Herbert Hoover signed Representative Lynn Thickum's bill making the Star Spangled Banner America's one and only national anthem.
It's like worse than the war-torn nations that you're looking at. That's worse than Afghanistan. The schools are failing. The jobs are leaving and millions are trapped in poverty. So to the African-American community, I say, vote for Donald Trump. I will fix it. I will fix it. What do you have to lose? Your education is broken. Your communities are unsafe. There are no jobs. What do you have to lose?
That was Donald Trump speaking about African-American issues. But true to Donald Trump, speaking to an all-white audience. The people that you heard, an all-white audience. Recently, Hillary Clinton decided to, and by the way, the right always gets pissed at her for not telling the truth. And then she speaks her mind and tells the absolute truth.
You know, to just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. And unfortunately, there are people like that. And he has lifted them up.
When I hear something like that, I think to myself that perhaps that candidate should take a look at himself, right? Maybe he should, hey, it is what she's saying, does it have any truth to it? And instead, what he did, and most will probably think that this is a good idea, is he decided to embrace the term.
Welcome to all of you deplorables.
And the right began referring to this as a gaffe on her part. Oh, how embarrassing this is. She's going after all of these hardworking Americans and she's calling them a basket of deplorables. But she was right. And that's what they don't want to talk about. So I recently caught Jamie Bowie on a talk show, and he decided to give you the science. Yeah, there is science to what Hillary Clinton said.
So I'm inclined to see it as strategy and not so much as a gaffe, because when I heard the remark, my first question was, well, is this true, right? Regardless of how it sounds or what it looks like, what is the case about Donald Trump supporters? And if you break down the numbers and you look at the Real Clear Politics average, and it gives Trump about 43% of the registered voters. So there's about 31 million people. Compare that to polls that show 65 to 70% of all Republicans who say Barack Obama either wasn't born in the United States or is a Muslim. You look at pilot data from the American National Election Study, and it shows upwards of 40% of Republicans saying things like, blacks are more violent, blacks are lazier, Muslims are more violent, Muslims are lazier. Among Trump supporters in particular, 60, 50, 70% of them agree with statements that political scientists categorize as being explicitly racist. So I'm looking at Clinton's statement, and half, which is about 31 million people again, doesn't really seem that out of bounds. 40 to 50% of Republicans, I would say, looking at the full spectrum of data, agree with beliefs that we would categorize as explicitly prejudiced.
And this group has decided to absolutely embrace this. They don't see it as a gaffe. I mean, they see it as a gaffe. How could she? How could she say something like this? It's absolutely not true. But what Hillary Clinton is pointing out is all the racist, sexist, homophobes, Islamophobes, all that. And the fact that white supremacy in the year 2016, you know, more than a century after we outlawed slavery, right? And like 50, 60 years after the Civil Rights Act, that in 2016, white supremacy has again been normalized and mainstreamed.
So if you look at Hillary Clinton's speech, where she basically pointed out that what Donald Trump has done actually quite well is normalize white supremacy, have one of a long list of things that I think many Americans would find distasteful.
And you would say that's true. The Clinton is right when she says that.
I think she made a very good argument, almost like a lawyer. Here is ways in which he has actually worked to normalize conversations that many people find hateful. And that many, listen, I've seen on air white supremacists being interviewed because they are Trump delegates, and they do a 5-minute segment, the first minute or so, talking about what they believe is white supremacists, right? So you have normalized that. Then Donald Trump will say, well, Hillary Clinton, she's a bigot. And it's covered, where the journalist part comes in, is they trade barbs. He says she's a bigot, and she points out that he might be appealing to racists.
He said, she said.
It only becomes he said, she said, when in actuality, the fact that Donald Trump has said she's a bigot without the long laundry list of evidence, which if you looked at Hillary Clinton's speech, she actually did have a lot of really good factual evidence that we would all agree are things that have happened and do exist. Mm. They're treated as if they're equal. Well, she might be a bigot. He might have ties to racists. They're actually equal when in reality they're not equal. And I think that's where journalists are failing in the contortions to try to make it seem fair.
As that segment went on, that's Soledad O'Brien on CNN. As that segment went on, it became pretty clear that the folks sitting with her were pretty uncomfortable that she was saying that. You got to understand, and I've explained this on the show before, the way they make money is by getting people to watch. The news isn't there to inform you, but every so often, they have those moments where the truth slips out. So, is Donald Trump really a racist, or does he just play one on TV and on the campaign trail? Should we even have racism? Does it make any sense? Why do politicians push nativism and the idea that we should look at each other with suspicion and scorn? And they use the most obvious thing, which is race. They use gender as well, but race is probably the number one way they do it. And clearly we've done it in this country for hundreds of years. So are we listening to our inner voices when we're being racist? Are we listening to our inner voices when we're being sexist? Or is this just one more way to divide us so that we can be conquered? One of my favorite comedians ever is Richard Pryor. I have made my wife, and I mean, she likes him to some degree too, but I have made my wife sit through many hours of Pryor's comedy. And one of the most amazing things I ever saw was a comedy show that he did back in 1976. And I wish I would, I'll pull the clip another time. And what he said was, you know, because he frequently, back during his day, would use the N-word. You know, you're my N-word, all this. You know, the same way a lot of African-Americans talk now. And then he was asked one day, someone just asked them, and they said, look around. What do you see? Well, I see people. More specifically, what do you see? You know, I'm doing this from memory. Oh, I see, you know, white people. I see black people. I see women. I see men. I see children. I see, you know, and it just sort of runs down the line. You know, all these races and religions and everything. And the guy goes, and I'm going to use the word. So if you don't want to hear the word, you can skip ahead about 20 seconds. And he goes, but do you see any niggers? And he goes, and it just hit me at that moment. And he goes, no. And he goes, and I just started crying. You know, because I just had this moment. And for whatever reason, it struck him. And he said, from this day forward, I will never, never refer to another person as a nigger. So back in 1976, he sat down for a television interview, and he was asked, why do you think racism is so prevalent? Why do you think we have so much of it in our society?
What do you think that these executives are afraid you're going to do to white America?
Probably stop some racism.
Stop racism?
Yeah. I'm probably afraid of that, because then people don't hate each other, and people start talking to each other, and then they start talking to each other, they find out who's the problem.
Which is?
Greedy people.
Greedy people. I have a couple things I want to ask you there. Do you really think that some of the guys that you dealt with at NBC, no names, right? Because there's lawsuits for that, too. That some of these guys really want to promote racism actively, or is it a subconscious?
I just think it's part of capitalism, is to promote racism, you know, right? In order to make things work. If you feel better because you're white and you can get a job, you use that. I mean, you know, I would.
Absolutely.
Say, I'm sorry, Jack, but shit, they say I'm white. I'm going to use this.
Right. Absolutely.
Get this job. I'm hungry, you know. But and that separates people. So they keep people separated, and that keeps them from thinking about the real problem. That's as simple as I see it. Probably it's not that simple, but.
Now, all right, you and I are about the same age, right? We're in our mid-30s. How long is it going to take before guys who think like you, and I say guys who think like me, people who don't want to have racism in the country, people who don't want to be oppressing any minority, whatever it is, sexual, whatever minority, really get into positions of power and can change things?
You can't get in a position of power, it seems, if you think like that. It seems that the only time you get in a position of power is if you like the people that are in power. To me, I mean, that's the way it goes. I mean, people that get to become executives become like the people that were already executives.
I don't know, maybe
they go in with good intentions, but it eats them up. It's like a cesspool. You know, it just gets on you and it starts eating.
The system levels them.
Pretty soon it's all gone.
Is that what a cesspool sounds like?
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
So in 2016, when a black man decides not to stand for the national anthem because of the way that African Americans are still suffering at the hand of police, which were initially, in America, the slave patrols, and decides not to stand for a song and takes massive heat, mostly from the right in this country, when he decides not to stand for a song that was written by an unrepentant racist, Francis Scott Key, a man who repeatedly sued black men who were trying to free slaves, sued white men who were trying to free slaves, and saw human bondage, as long as it was only extended over the African Americans, as acceptable. And Colin Kaepernick decides not to stand for this song, and he takes all kinds of heat, but he ain't throwed. At this moment, he is still not standing. He's decided at this point to get down on one knee, which is considered acceptable, but he is still getting hate from all kinds of conservatives. How dare he not stand for this racist song? Now, we've dropped the third verse out of that song, so we try to say it's not racist anymore. But the intention is still the same. The author is still the same. But stay strong, Brother Kaepernick. Don't get throwed.
First person in history who wouldn't stay throwed was a little baby born in Bethlehem of Judea. And that baby grew up, created a tumult. They put him in a grave, and 3 days later, the world knew he wouldn't stay throwed. Now, here's a warning to those who might be tempted to spend the next 4 years trying to knock Hillary Clinton down. You better get ready for a woman who won't stay throwed. They threw her down as the first lady, but she didn't stay throwed. They threw her down as a U.S. senator, but she wouldn't stay throwed. They threw her down as a secretary of state, but she wouldn't stay throwed. They threw her down in this very campaign, but she won't stay thrown. No, she ain't gonna stay thrown. She won't stay thrown. She won't stay thrown. You better listen to me. I said she won't stay thrown.
What do you think is going on?
It could be Parkinson's. It could be MS.
It could be AIDS.
What makes you think she has AIDS?
The way her husband used to be.
So you think Bill had AIDS?
Yes.
So how did Bill Clinton get AIDS?
Probably messing around with Magic Johnson.
That's the natural conclusion?
Yeah.
It's amazing. This isn't... Now I understand this clip. They're talking to Trump supporters. And this is from The Daily Show. I didn't get permission for it. I don't care. Come after me. But it's amazing. How do people walk around in America so wildly ill-informed and willingly jump in front of a camera and will share the most ignorant crap you've ever heard in your life and do it shamelessly and do it with a straight face and believe it in their hearts? How in the hell does this happen? Ladies and gentlemen, whether you realize it or not, you are living in an America created by talk radio. And I know this, I've been listening to talk radio, largely conservative talk radio, for more than 10 years now. Today, even right now, we're in late September, early October 2016, I still absorb about an hour or two of conservative audio and video media every day. And that's not on top of blogs, written articles, things of that nature. About 2 hours a day I spend absorbing conservative media. And I do so because I want to hear the talking points. So the economy has getting been getting better, right? After the great crash, 2007, 2008, it's taken a long time for it to get better because Congress was standing up and fighting every single thing that President Obama wanted to do, but it has still been getting better. And so the Republicans still want to say that, dag nabbit, this president's doing a terrible job. But it's hard to say that when there's hundreds of thousands of more jobs every month and the unemployment rate's going down and you know, interest rates are staying low and the stock market's going down. It's really hard to say that, but they always find a way to spin it in the worst way possible. So one of the things I hear on conservative talk radio is about the labor participation rate. It's, there are 90 million people out of work. Well, how is the unemployment rate 4.9%? There's 90 million people that are out of work, and it's all President Obama's fault. Well, what about Congress? Does Congress not pass? Oh, you heard me. It's all the President Obama's fault because he's a Kenyan Muslim. You know the way this goes, right? And they just start foaming. So what the hell is that? Are there 90 million people? Americans that are out of work that want work.
Probably heard some of Donald Trump's conspiracy theories about how the economy is doing.
The 5% figure is one of the biggest hoaxes in American modern politics.
Well, he gets his talking points about the economy straight from right-wing media. The economy has been in a slow recovery since the financial crisis and recession, but right-wing media straight-up lie about the state of the economy, specifically how many people are working or not working. One of their favorite claims is that more than 90 million Americans, or roughly 40% of the adult population, are unemployed. And they also talk about the labor force participation rate supposedly being too low. We want to clear this up, but first you need to understand what the labor force is. The labor force is made up of people older than 16 who work or are employed, and those who are actively looking for work or are unemployed, plus members of the armed forces. The rate of unemployment was 10% in October of 2009 following the financial crisis, but is now 4.9% as of August 2016. So that 42% figure we mentioned earlier, well, they're not in the labor force, but that doesn't mean they're unemployed. Why? Because they're students, they're retired, they're institutionalized in mental health or penal facilities, or they have family responsibilities. They don't have a job, and the vast majority are not actively looking for one. Conservative pundits like to cite the labor force participation rate, which is the percentage of the population that is in the labor force, as proof that the economy is in decline. Right-wing media love to use this rate because it is downward trending. The unemployment rate has been steadily getting better for nearly 6 years, and they can't complain about it. Long before President Obama took office, economists predicted the labor force participation rate to decrease because baby boomers were expected to retire. And in fact, roughly 10,000 people reach retirement age every day. Labor force participation peaked during the Clinton administration, and Obama inherited an economy in the midst of a deep recession from President Bush. So blaming Obama for an imaginary economic decline is just a misinformation. Many economists agree that the employment-to-population ratio is a better measure of economic health. It represents the number of jobs available as a proportion of the total population, and the ratio has been gradually improving since the end of the recession. These myths are harmful. A recent study found that even though the U.S. unemployment rate is 4.9%, 57% of Americans believe it is a lot higher, proving right-wing media's bullshit actually sticks.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is what we call spin. It's not the truth. What's happening in conservative media is not the truth. And a lot of the things you hear being said from the stage by Donald Trump, a lot of the things you hear on television being said by right-wing pundits, all of this stuff is tested on talk radio. It comes from Washington, D.C. think tanks. They focus group test, you know, what works. This works, that doesn't work, this works, that doesn't work. Then they test it on talk radio. They watch it start to trend, and then they take it to television. They take it to the written media, you know, articles and all that stuff, and then it gets out there. And then it becomes truth. And I'm doing air quotes. Truth for conservatives. Not real truth, truth. We've known for some, these are the baby boomers. The people that are retiring, getting out of the labor force, the baby boomers. Also, Obamacare allowed a lot of people to retire early too because they were able to buy health insurance on the open market rather than it being attached to their jobs. So they got to retire early. When the hell did that become a bad thing? There is the truth And then there's right-wing truth. These are, I got air quotes around truth. But you have to be careful because there's a lot of this out there. And these people are shameful. And they believe it, no matter how absolutely untrue it is.
Barack Obama had big part of 9/11.
Which part?
Not being around, always on vacation, never in the office.
Why do you think Barack Obama wasn't in the Oval Office on 9/11?
That I don't know. We'd like to get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, we should get to the bottom of that. Why the hell wasn't he president when 9/11 happened? Holy, we would really like to believe that he played a role in 9/11. Why the hell wasn't he in the White House? See what happens when you believe complete BS? There is a lot of good information out there, and I would encourage you to find it. I appreciate you coming to this show. I'm never going to lie to you. Yeah, I've got a slant to the things that I say. But if I say something that's not true, it's going to be pretty easy to disprove. Also, it's going to be easy to tell that it's not true because I'm a really cruddy liar. And so I just want to say this. Be more discerning with where you get your information because there's a lot of misinformation out there. Be ready and be patient when you deal with a conservative or a Trumper or a gun humper or one of these nitwits that believes things that are not true. You got to be careful with them because they're very fragile. And you want to find a way to set them straight that isn't too caustic or confrontational. Because these right-wing myths become truth if they get to sit out there for too long. The economy is better, way better than it was 8 years ago. And it continues to get better. That's an absolute truth. Black men are being killed right now in America, unarmed black men, and they're being given that power to murder and get away with murder by the state. That is absolutely true. You cannot argue that. And the Star Spangled Banner was written by a totally unrepentant racist, a hardcore racist. And if you do not stand for that song, I stand with you, or I kneel with you. I will never stand for the Star Spangled Banner ever again. If we truly aspire to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, we should be able to examine the real history of America and the Star Spangled Banner, and most importantly, the degree to which that history is still alive today. Our current difficulty in facing our past, honestly and soberly, strongly suggest that we are still a long way from laying it to rest. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. You can also find us on Kiwi Station. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or on Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.